It turns out that if when you eat, you produce, of course, a lot of insulin. But a lot of that insulin that you produce, which is necessary to be glucose tolerant, as we call it, to be able to tolerate glucose, you need to have a stimulation from the gut of insulin secretion. And there are two hormones that do this, and they are the incretin hormones. One is called GLP-1, the other one is called GIP, and they are responsible for this amplification.
Welcome to the GLP-1 Podcast Show, a monthly podcast where you'll find cutting-edge insights and all that's working in the world of metabolic health and obesity care. Our aspiration is to be the first place you are going to go to find out what's happening, the latest updates, and the latest research in GLP-1 science and clinical practice.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the GLP-1 podcast show hosted by Wisenetics. I'm Arisha Moyes, a clinical researcher from McGill University. And today I'm extremely honored to be joined by Dr. Jens Holst, a professor of medical physiology at the University of Copenhagen, as well as a senior group leader at the Novo Nordisk Foundation Center for Basic Metabolic Research. So Dr. Holst is world-renowned for his pioneering research on gut hormones and is actually one of the scientists who co-discovered GLP-1 in the 80s. His work has laid the foundation for today's incretin-based therapies, transforming diabetes and obesity care worldwide. Over his career, he has published almost 2,000 scientific papers, received prestigious international awards, and continues to be a leading voice in metabolic research today, inspiring many young scientists like myself. So it really is truly a privilege to have him here with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. So, to start off, we're going to start off by just laying the foundations of incretin biology. So can you explain what incretins are and what has made GLP-1 stand out compared to others in regulating glucose and appetite?
Yeah, so it turns out that when you eat, you produce, of course, a lot of insulin. But a lot of that insulin that you produce, which is necessary to be glucose tolerant, as we call it, to be able to tolerate glucose, you need to have a stimulation from the gut of insulin secretion. And there are two hormones that do this, and they are the incretin hormones. One is called GLP-1, the other one is called GIP, and they are responsible for this amplification. And then it has, you know, this was the original assignment to try to find out which hormones are responsible for this incretin effect. And GIP came on the market, and it was okay, but it didn't work in people with diabetes, so the enthusiasm was dampened somewhat. But then GLP-1 came along, and it worked in people with diabetes. So that was one part of the success, of course, that it still had that activity. And then as we were working with this new hormone, we also found out that it inhibited food intake and appetite. And that, of course, raised the possibility that it also could be useful in the treatment of obesity. It took quite a while to get there. There were many obstacles on the way, but eventually we got there.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Okay, amazing. And you were actually among the scientists who first discovered GLP-1. So can you take us back a little bit to that moment? What led to its discovery and what were those early years of research like?
One can say that we were looking for it. So we are now back to in the early 70s where we were interested in understanding this new incretin mechanism. And as I said, GIP came along but couldn't really explain everything. So I was looking for another hormone in the gut of both people, and we were using pigs as experimental animals. And we were using a number of approaches to find out what was happening. And we found some cells, and they were interesting. They were reacting with antibodies against glucagon. And we started to try to find out what was in those cells. It turned out that the substance that was in them was a precursor for glucagon, the glucagon prohormone. And eventually, as we worked more and more with that hormone, we found out that this prohormone also contained unknown, hitherto unknown glucagon-like stretches. And these unknown stretches, glucagon-like peptide 1 and glucagon-like peptide 2, turned out to be real hormones produced in their own right from the gut. And one, GLP-1, also had effect on insulin secretion, and the other one had effect on the mucosal growth in the small intestine. It is actually a very, very interesting hormone also. So that's what happened. We were looking for it and we found it.
I spoke to Dr. Nock the other day and I kind of asked him a similar question. But at that time, did you imagine that this hormone would one day form the basis of like an entirely new class of therapies?
No, but we presented our first findings about this in at the diabetes meeting in Madrid in 1985. And Michael Nauck was there also with his new fiancée. And I also brought my girlfriend and we became very close friends. So we decided to work together on this. And he was very much interested in the incretins and we had this new candidate. So we joined forces and started to look for, at the effects of the new hormone in people with diabetes. And that was really the turning point because it was possible to demonstrate that you could completely normalize glucose levels in people with this new hormone. So that was in 93 and it was the big turning point.
It's really funny that you mentioned Madrid because I was just in Madrid for the ESC conference. I was presenting a poster there. So it's very inspiring for me specifically, just like hearing about the evolution and like your trajectory when it comes to research. So moving a little bit on to the medicine aspect. So in recent years, GLP-1s have moved past diabetes from obesity to cardiovascular health. So how do you see this evolution compared to where the field started?
So the effect on food intake and appetite on food and food intake was there. You know, it was something that we looked for quite early, and that's because it was known that the gut would produce hormones that could inhibit appetite and food intake, and cholecystokinin, another gut hormone, was found to inhibit food intake. So this is one of the things what we look for, and eventually we found that yes, it did inhibit appetite and food intake. So this was on the list also. And now, of course, we were very eager to try to treat people, both with diabetes and with obesity, of course. So we started injecting people with the GLP-1 that was available in those days, natural GLP-1. And it did work, you know, it had marvelous effects on insulin secretion, but it also had severe side effects. So the more we gave of the substance, the more people were ill and started to vomit. So this was putting a limit to this. And this has actually been the problem ever since, to find the correct balance between the side effects and the effects of the peptide. So that was one of the many obstacles that came along to try to find out how you could do this. Eventually, it was found that another huge problem was the half-life of the molecule, which was extremely short. So something had to be done about that. We found out that it was the enzyme DPP4 that was responsible, and we could demonstrate that inhibitors of this enzyme would also protect the hormone, and that eventually led to the development of the DPP4 inhibitors that have been used all over the globe for diabetes therapy in the last 20 years. This was a huge success, but they're not as good as the GLP-1 agonists. So we also found out that you could stabilize the GLP-1 agonists so that they were not destroyed by the enzyme. But there was still the problem with the kidneys. And so eventually Novo Nordisk was able to solve that problem by attaching a fatty acid chain to the molecule, and then it would bind to albumin in the circulation and avoid the clearance in the kidneys. So this was the secret behind liraglutide, which was the first of the long-acting GLP-1s that came on the market. And that substance, of course, had its effect, fortunately, on diabetes and also a somewhat small but significant effect on food intake and body weight. But then it was felt that, maybe if we could do something, perhaps some way we could increase the dose, could it be stronger on food intake and appetite? And that was tried. And it turned out that you had to up-titrate the dosing very slowly. And if you did that, you could increase the doses more. And eventually, they did a dose response study. At a high dose of 3 milligrams was demonstrated to be more effective, so that we now had weight losses around 7-8%, which was something. And that led to a whole development program, which was called the SCALE program. And out of that came Saxenda, which is liraglutide in a 3-milligram dose that then was approved for obesity therapy. So that was the first of all, the first development in this field. And of course, that was successful. But then in the meantime, the second generation GLP-1s had been developed. And among those, semaglutide, which is a more long-lasting version of GLP-1 with a half-life of 1 week. And I was myself participating in the development of this compound. And, you know, it had to be better on insulin, it had to be better on appetite and food intake, and it had to have a half-life of 1 week. And we managed to do all of that. And we were very proud when it was finally delivered to development. So this was a better compound. And again, in the registration studies for this, there was a nice weight loss of 7 to 8% or something like that. And again, it was felt that maybe if the doses could be increased a little bit, so this was with 1 milligram of semaglutide, if we could increase the doses somewhat, could we also get a higher weight loss? And again, a new dose response study was created. And in this study, doses up to what turned out to be 2.4 milligrams per week were investigated, and they caused a weight loss of 15%. And that formed the basis for a whole development program, registration program, which is called the STEP trials, where a large number of people with, not with diabetes, but with obesity and various complications were looked at. And now in the STEP program, we had weight losses of up to 18% of body weight. And that was approved for obesity therapy. And that started the whole craze, you know, that we have today. Let me comment also on the cardiovascular safety of this. This was really unknown. Of course, people would expect that something that could cause a weight loss and that could improve your glucose levels strongly and perhaps also your lipid levels would have some effect on cardiovascular risk. And so what happened was that in 2015, the SGLT1 inhibitors were introduced, and the so-called EMPA-REG study demonstrated for the first time ever that a diabetes compound could have a beneficial effect on cardiovascular risk. It improved cardiovascular risk by 13%. The data were presented in the Congress in Stockholm, EASD Congress in Stockholm, and it was hugely exciting. We were all completely crazy. We were standing on the chairs. We were shouting and waving because this was a sensation. It was the first time it was seen. Half a year later, the cardiovascular outcome trial with liraglutide was introduced at the ADA meeting in the United States. And it was extremely exciting whether the GLP-1s could do something similar. Fortunately, they could. So the Novo Nordisk medical director was grouping people before the screen, you know, and telling us all, remember to be very happy, remember to jump on the chairs and shout when you see the results. But they were as good. They were really, really good. And that was the LEADERS trial. And then, of course, this has been followed up by semaglutide. And semaglutide has been through a cardiovascular outcome trial in no less than in people with obesity, but no diabetes, in no less than 17,600 people that have been followed for 4 years. And in that study, the cardiovascular risk was reduced by 20%. And that tells us that you can really do something about these complications of obesity. The cardiovascular risk can be reduced very significantly, and the risk of getting new diabetes can also be reduced very strongly. So this is important.
I really like how you mentioned the molecular components of GLP-1, because I feel like sometimes we're like so focused on the clinical outcomes that we lose sight of truly the innovation that brought us here from that early discovery of this peptide. And I can really see your excitement really shining through while you're just talking about this whole journey. And it's actually interesting because I was at AHA in Philadelphia when Select was presented. And I do remember it was actually like one of the first international conferences I attended. And I presented a poster on the long-term efficacy and safety of semaglutide. it's semaglutide, but for me, I've always called it semaglutide, so that naturally comes out. I'm trying to adjust my pronunciation, but it was a meta-analysis. So, like, I can't imagine where this field will take off from this moment, you know, like we're constantly building on what we know. And now it's interesting because beyond obesity, we're looking at obesity related conditions, like kind of adjacent. So like sleep apnea, osteoarthritis, PCOS, fatty liver disease. Can you comment a little bit on how these benefits are being observed in these conditions? Are they weight mediated mostly, or are there other mechanisms at play here with GLP-1s?
So as we said a moment ago, the whole thing started with improvement in glucose levels, and they are there, and that will happen in all groups that will have improved glucose metabolism. You will also have improvements in lipid parameters and circulating lipids. But there are other things that really go on. So there are, and the weight, it's well demonstrated that a weight loss in itself will have profound metabolic consequences. And we know that, amongst others, from the bariatric surgery results that also have very profound beneficial effects on metabolism and complications of obesity. But the GLP-1s have two other mechanisms of action that are really important here. One is that some of the receptors for GLP-1, they sit in the blood vessels. And it's been demonstrated over and over again that GLP-1 has beneficial actions on these small vessels, in particularly if they're exposed to damage. For instance, atherosclerotic damage, you can prevent or delay that with the GLP-1s. So you have a mechanism of action for the GLP-1s, which is really all over the body because, I mean, the circulation is common to all tissues and organs. And the other one is inflammation. So obesity and diabetes are accompanied by a low-grade inflammation, as you know, and it is thought that cytokines from this low-grade inflammation, particularly from the adipose tissue, are responsible for some of the complications of obesity. And now it turns out that GLP-1 has a profound effect on this low-grade inflammation, judging from the circulating markers of inflammation, which are very much improved by the GLP-1 receptor agonists. So you have, on top of the metabolic improvements with the glucose and the lipids and all that, you also have an effect on the blood vessels and on inflammation. Together, all of these factors probably explain the beneficial actions you can have on so many organs, that is the heart, the liver, the kidneys, the lungs, and the brain. Because one of the problems is that the GLP-1s, they do not enter the brain. They cannot enter the brain, but they still have apparently profound actions in the brain, and they do that by interacting with receptors in some what we call the circumventricular organs. These are leaks in the blood-brain barrier at certain sites. So they can interact with these sites and activate the neurons that then pass on the messages. But they also, of course, are influenced by the inflammation that you have, the general low-grade inflammation, and also they have the circulatory system like any other organ. So I think the most likely explanation for all this is these effects on the whole system. And that's why we can also expect to have good effects on something like the neurodegenerative diseases, even if it doesn't address them directly.
It's really incredible, these pleiotropic effects. I've heard sometimes people refer to GLP-1s kind of analogous to statins, where they're targeting all these other tissues and conditions that we didn't even expect or anticipate. So you commented on this a little bit earlier, but so these GI side effects, so nausea, vomiting, can you talk a little bit about like the mechanisms, like why does this happen? What is the molecule doing, GLP-1, to cause these side effects in patients?
So again, it seems that these side effects are elicited by interactions with the sites in the brain where also the other effects are elicited, those on appetite and food intake. There are a lot of people that are working on trying to separate the two things, the side effects. And it may be possible. It seems that there is one region that is more involved in the regulation of appetite and food intake and another region that is more responsible for the side effects. But so far, it's the same receptor, and it's really going to be very difficult to separate those two. It's interesting that tirzepatide, which is, you know, another GLP-1 receptor antagonist, agonist, also has GIP actions, because it's been claimed that the GIP action actually improves the side effect profile of GLP-1, so that this could be one of the mechanisms whereby this is particularly effective, and that you can increase the dosing with just tirzepatide because you have this built-in mechanism, you can say. But this is not, unfortunately, not proven yet. It may be true, though, so let's see about that. But people are trying to work on this. The general advice is that people should take it easy. They should be really, really slow in the up-titration of the dosing. Use half a year for that, you know, and stay on the lower doses if there are problems with the higher doses. And it turns out that those that experience problems at the lower doses still have the same beneficial effects on metabolism as those that manage to get to the higher doses. So there are all reasons to make a slow up titration of the dosing and avoid the problems.
It's really incredible just looking at these drugs and the effects. And even you commented a little bit on the neurodegenerative effects, like who would have thought we would end up here? So I'm really excited about it. I know you're really excited about it. But I think there is still a little bit of skepticism in the general public about these miracle drugs, how they seem to be benefiting so many different conditions. Can you comment on, I guess, some of the rarer side effects? Like, I know pancreatitis is a common issue that comes up, some biliary disorders. How common really are these, and are they troublesome? Is this something we should worry about when prescribing these drugs to patients?
So fortunately, there are quite a number of studies that have addressed this, and there are some very recent studies on very big patient groups where this has been looked at in detail. And the good news is that they are the real problems, they are very, very rare. Pancreatitis is a very small problem that only arises in very few cases. The problem is, of course, that both obesity and diabetes in themselves are associated with an increased risk of pancreatitis. So when you treat people with obesity and diabetes, you already have an increased risk of pancreatitis, and people very often are confused by this and then blame the drug. But that's not really, in very big control studies, this is not a big problem. It's really a small problem. The bile problems, the gallbladder problems, are a little bit more factual, because this is actually true. There is a slight increase, and we're down in very low percentages here, of gallstones being formed. The frequency of gallstone, of complicated bile system diseases, is not increased, but the gallbladder is, and it is known that people that lose weight also have an increased risk for creating gallstones. Maybe it's associated with the weight effect. There could be also other explanations, but this is not certain at all. So this is a real problem, but it's very, very small again. So in general, you know, the problems with these compounds or the effects of these compounds are always associated with interaction with the receptor, because the levels are low, and that's the only way they can work. And it's, after all, it's a natural substance in the body. So I don't think there are any bad excuses, you know, surprises for us. They've been on the market now for 20 years. We have a lot of experience. Very, very many people have received them. You know, they say that 14% of the Americans have been on a GLP-1 agonist now, but perhaps even more. It's millions and millions of people that we're looking at here. There are some problems that you need to take care of while you are on therapy, and that is, if you lose a lot of weight, you have to be very careful about your nutrition. So you need to supplement or be sure that your diet is a good quality with sufficient amounts of protein and vitamins and all those things that are important, but also when in bariatric surgery, for instance, where you have a similar situation. So this is very, very important. In addition, not to lose lean body mass, you have to take care of that. And how do you do that? You do that by exercising a little bit. It doesn't take a lot. You know, it just takes half an hour daily walk to maintain your lean body mass, your muscle mass. But the good news is that this is going to be easier for you because of the weight loss and because of the removal of the inflammation and removal of joint inflammation and things like that. So it will be easier, and eventually it will be possible. And as I said, it's not a lot. It doesn't require you to spend a lot of time at the exercise centers. And in addition, you know, to improve your diet, this is easy also. It's getting easier because you've lost this preoccupation with what you eat and the murmur of the noise of food that people describe. So it's easier to do this. And those things are very, very important for the success of the therapy.
So you kind of beat me to my next question already when you started talking about these nutritional deficiencies and kind of preservation of the lean body mass. But I was going to ask, are there still limitations or challenges with GLP-1 therapies that researchers are trying to overcome?
Yeah. So I, as you know, I think that there's a difference with age here. You have to consider for middle-aged people with overweight, I mean, there's no problem really. But for elderly people with a decreasing muscle mass and strength, if you start losing a lot of weight in these people, you may have a problem with the muscle mass. And that's why in these individuals, the maintenance of the muscle mass is even more important. It's even more important to have a high-quality diet with vitamins and proteins, and to maintain the muscle mass by exercising. Not a lot, again, still thinking about the individual. For elderly people, you also have to consider fluid balance, fluid intake, that they drink sufficient amounts of water and fluids, because there is an effect also on blood pressure of all these, which is beneficial for most people. But if you then do not maintain your extracellular volume, your body water, which is a risk in elderly individuals, then there's another risk. It's rare, but it's there.
Okay, perfect. So I know I keep reiterating this, but I just want to say it. Like, as someone so early in my career, I find it very inspiring that discoveries made in the lab decades ago are now transforming patients' lives. Like, I know you said almost 13% of Americans have used a GLP-1 at one point. That's very like staggering numbers. So how do you hope that your work will continue to inspire the next generation of scientists?
So as long as there are so many problems that we need to solve, I really hope that somebody will continue this work. And as we've talked about already, the target for these drugs is really the part of the population that has the complications of obesity and also diabetes. So I'm talking about those with the metabolic syndrome, and that's about a quarter of the adult population. And they have these disturbances of blood lipids and blood glucose and blood pressure and abdominal obesity that are associated with an increased cardiovascular risk, stroke, myocardial infarction, or death. Premature, threefold increases in the risk, and the recent research with all these compounds, as we discussed the SELECT trial, has demonstrated that it works. They work. You can treat it. You can address this problem, and that's why I hope that all of this will lead to that all these people that have this problem that they can receive this kind of medication. That requires, of course, that it will be a lot cheaper. And that there will be more of it. I mean, we have a supply shortage these days, and it's serious. And that's why I think that, you know, the new development with orally active small molecules activating the GLP-1 receptor can be a solution, because they are easier to produce and they will be cheaper than the kind of biologics that we're working with right now. At any circumstances, there are many, many companies now ready to produce a lot of the GLP-1s. So there's no doubt that competition will lead to a decreasing price level. So the price level and the supply are problems that I really hope it will be possible to overcome in the future.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Holtz, for sharing your story and your insights. It's honestly really rare for me to speak to someone whose basic science discoveries have really directly transformed modern medicine. And I think it's really a reminder of how curiosity and research can have an enormous impact on patients' lives. So thank you so much. And also to our listeners, thank you for tuning into the GLP-1 podcast show. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, comment, and subscribe. We really appreciate your support. Till next time, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with APA Time Zone Hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.